This is the Education Gadfly Show.
But they did find effects.
Sound effect.
But they...
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming our special guest for this week, Dr. Samantha Viano. Samantha, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Viano is an assistant professor of education at George Mason University, and she was also an external reviewer for our new study out just last week. We're going to talk about it, called Gotta Give 'Em Credit, State and District Variation in Credit Recovery Rates. Whew, that's a handful. Also joining us, our curmudgeon, David Griffith.
Present and accounted for.
Very good. Well, lots to talk about, Samantha, on the topic of credit recovery, which, as we found in our new study, is incredibly widespread. This is something happening all over the country. Let's get to it in Ed Reform Update. So, Samantha, you know, as we say in our study, it looks like about two-thirds of traditional high schools out there are doing credit recovery. It tends to be a fairly small number of kids at most schools doing it, 8% on average, I think we found. But there are some of these schools out there, almost 10% of high schools, where there's a big chunk of kids doing it, one in five or more. And perhaps not surprisingly, these schools tend to be bigger. They tend to be urban. They tend to serve lots of poor kids and kids of color. And as we have dug into this, other folks like Nat Malkus, AEI, other folks around the country, there is this concern that some of these credit recovery programs in high schools may be being used to, in effect, lower graduation requirements, lower the standards. In other words, let kids pass and get a diploma, even though they are not anywhere near ready to meet those standards. Now, we don't know that from our report. We are just looking at the data from the Office for Civil Rights and tallying it up and looking at the trends by state and district. What we don't know very much of is whether this stuff is actually high quality. You know, look, we say, you know, this is a form of competency-based education. From that respect, it might be positive to say we're not going to require kids to sit in class a certain number of hours.
When you say it out loud, though, Mike, that doesn't sound great, right?
I mean, well, look, competency-based could say, look, yeah, I mean, you know, it shouldn't just be seat time. Let's let kids go faster or find other ways to prove what they know. If that's what credit recovery is, then great. But is it? So, Samantha, you have been doing work on this topic. Tell us about the work you've been doing and what it tells us about the quality of these programs.
Yeah, so just to respond a little bit to what you were saying, I think there is this idea of an ideal credit recovery student, one that would really benefit from a competency-based approach. Mm-hmm. But the issue with credit recovery courses is that students who fail classes typically are not that kind of student. Mm-hmm. They are typically students who struggle academically, who have low reading levels and struggle with complicated online platforms. Mm-hmm. So they're not the kind of student who you would think could sail through courses that they don't need to sit through mm-hmm. traditionally, which is one of the major arguments against enrolling at-risk students in credit recovery mm-hmm. courses.
And of course, we should say that not all credit recovery is online, though probably a lot of it is at this point. What do we know about it? And again, tell us more about your work.
Yeah, so in my work, for instance, I found that in North Carolina, students tend to retake classes in full with a teacher. So that's like traditional credit recovery. So mm-hmm. a 2-to-1 ratio of traditional credit recovery to online credit recovery. Okay. So it's still more popular to take courses traditionally, but online credit recovery is growing and it's outpacing enrollments in repeating courses in full. So it's crowding out the traditional option of credit recovery. So online is becoming more popular. Mm-hmm. And as far as quality, I have found evidence in my work when I've used more sophisticated quantitative methods to try to isolate the effect of credit recovery on students. I've found that the online courses do help students graduate faster. Mm-hmm. Within 4 years and helps prevent dropout. And these effects are particularly pronounced for students of color and economically disadvantaged students. So they particularly mm-hmm. benefit from credit recovery courses.
But is this a good thing or a bad thing?
I have some evidence, although using data from North Carolina, the test score data is a little spotty in high school, but I have some evidence that the higher high school graduation rates are matched with lower test scores. Test scores on things like the ACT and end of course exams.
Right. So these are very low achieving kids.
Yes.
It is helping them get to a diploma. So partly it depends on what your view of high school diplomas is, right? Yeah. That, there's the argument that says, hey, you know, we're trying to help these kids have some shot at decent employment and things like that. And so
it might be more accurate, Mike, to say that your view of high school diplomas depends on your view of online credit recovery.
Well, what do you mean?
I mean that increasingly, right? My view of the high school diploma is that it's worth whatever we put into it.
Yeah.
Right. And so, it's sort of a circular argument, right?
Yeah. But meaning what? Okay, that people would say, well, look, we know there are not high standards for graduation in most states, right? That the high school diploma has become some kind of certificate of completion. And in the old days, that at least meant that you were willing to sit there through all these courses and do enough to get a passing grade. And while that doesn't mean you were necessarily a great scholar, it showed some degree of persistence and grit. And now, with online credit recovery, maybe it doesn't even show that. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I have a hard time not having a very cynical take on this particular issue. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the kids who are taking these courses are precisely the opposite of the kind of kids who are most likely to benefit from online settings. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. As I was saying, they have low reading levels. Often they struggle with the online platform itself because they have trouble understanding the kind of like modules they have in the course.
I know you said it's tentative, but I mean, I just want a point of clarification. Is it credit recovery that is matched with low test scores, or is it online credit recovery specifically?
Online credit recovery.
Okay, meaning it's even worse than not online brick and mortar credit recovery?
Yes. So whenever I'm making comparisons, sorry, this wasn't clear. Whenever I'm making comparisons, the comparisons are between students who fail courses and whether or not they choose online versus in-person courses.
Oh my goodness. Well, so, and the fundamental challenge, it seems to me, is that the companies that are selling these online credit recovery programs, they are the ones deciding, by and large, if the kids have passed or not. Right, that they have these proprietary systems, and embedded in those systems or part of those systems are assessments that decide if the kids met the competencies. And if you're selling these products, you may have an incentive to make it rather easy for kids to pass. Right, and if you're a district wanting to boost its graduation rates, same deal. There's no external check. I mean, so one option could be, look, really make it competency. So sure, the kid can take the course online, but they should still have to pass some kind of external test. And maybe that should go for kids that are taking traditional courses too.
I think that would definitely be an incentive for the private companies to increase the quality and rigor of their courses, because there's a definite incentive for low quality coursework, because schools want high pass rates. They don't want to pay a company per student enrollment and then have to pay them again the next semester because the student failed.
Yeah, it's sounds a little bit like a diploma mill. No? Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that all three of us are in agreement. We have some concerns about this.
Despite...
One last question, Samantha. Do we have any idea to what degree the spike in the national graduation rate is being driven by online credit recovery? Is there any way we could figure out that answer? I mean, I'd love to think that it's not the whole story, that the higher graduation rate also reflects that we are doing a better job teaching kids. Certainly, you see from the early 2000s, big improvements in achievement in fourth graders, let's say, in reading and math for the lowest performing kids. And then those kids go through the system and more of them would graduate. That's one story you can tell. But we don't really know. The other story is that, no, it's all a big fraud. The only reason the graduation rate's going up is because a bunch of high schools are buying these credit recovery programs. Do we have any way to figure this out?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I would love to explore whether or not credit recovery is the main reason or not. I mean, my work points that it could be one of the reasons, but when I've tried to isolate this at the school level to see if schools are directly using credit recovery to increase graduation rates, I have trouble finding evidence of that.
All right. Smart people out there, if you can think about how we can study this, please let us know, because it really is the million-dollar question. Well, thanks for joining us again, Samantha Viano, assistant professor at George Mason University. Appreciate your help with our study and coming on the show.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Adam Tyner, welcome back to the show.
How y'all doing?
We're well. Adam, standing in for Amber yet again. Adam, we were just talking about the great study that you and our colleague Nicholas came out with last week on credit recovery. I got to say, we were talking to Samantha there. She's one of our reviewers for the study. I don't think any of the three of us are particularly optimistic that credit recovery is making our schools better. In fact, even after we had a quick conversation with her, we were discussing how there are now this dynamic that kids who are struggling in a class will say, well, forget it. I'm not even going to worry about doing the work. I'll just fail this and I'll just take credit recovery instead. It'll be a lot easier to pass the class that way.
Boy, the more I learn about these programs, the more concerned I get. I've learned a lot from Samantha about them. She's really the big expert on it. And the more I hear, the more worried I get.
We have found a way to make our schools even worse. Good work, team. Okay, but enough pessimism for the week. Do you have some good news for us for a change, Adam?
Well, maybe. We're a few weeks away from falling back from daylight savings time, but this week we have a new study just released in the journal AERA Open on another type of time shift, high school start times, and it has some ideas that could be good news, maybe. There's obviously been some work on this before, but this new study is by researchers at UNC Chapel Hill, and is entitled Answering the Bell, High School Start Times and Student Academic Outcomes. The researchers used data from education researchers' new favorite state. Y'all want to guess?
North Carolina.
It's our favorite. Be nice if more states were like them. Let us use their data, huh? But they were answering two main questions in the study. First, do later high school start times predict absences, suspensions, and academic achievement? And second, if so, do later high school start times have larger impacts on the absences, suspensions, and academic outcomes of traditionally disadvantaged student subgroups? Academic achievement includes student test scores, but also grades, and interestingly, grades in the first period, which would presumably be more affected by school start times. To the results. When they looked at all types of students together, the researchers found that school start times were not correlated with absences, average course grades, or students' test scores, either the end of course tests or the ACT. But they did find effects.
That was my sound effect there.
But they did find effects of later start times on, I think you guys would be interested in this, they found effects on suspensions as well as on the first period grades, the grades on for the first class of the day. The effect on suspensions was actually pretty large, which is notable. The effect for first period grades was pretty small. But for traditionally advantaged students, the impacts are stronger. Not only are those students less likely to be suspended and have higher grades in the first period when they attend a school with a later start time, like the average for everyone, but also they had higher grades overall, and they had generally slightly higher test scores, although there were some differences for different tests. The stronger effects for traditionally disadvantaged students might make you wonder, what about the other students, the non-traditionally disadvantaged? And as you might expect, since there was no overall effect for some of these outcomes, there were actually some small negative effects from the later start times on other students. Economically advantaged students actually had slightly more absences in schools with later start times when they looked at just white students. They also found that their overall GPAs were ever so slightly lower in the schools that had later start times. But those were pretty small effects. A couple of takeaways. Obviously, I guess we could certainly narrow some gaps by implementing later start times, although maybe bringing some students down isn't the best way to do that. But really, the effects on discipline are the ones that I think are most interesting here. They are the only really large effects that the study found. And, you know, we're interested in ways to lessen discipline disparities without ignoring bad behavior or anything like that. And starting school a little later might be a way to do that.
Very interesting. Hey, you know, I got to take the bait on suspensions here. You know, we have been part of a big debate on whether the disparities in suspensions are being driven by basically teacher racial bias, especially, or the systemic bias, or differences in student behavior. And here, it makes me wonder, it could be that the students are getting more sleep and they're behaving better in the classroom. That would make you think that there's some evidence for behavior. But the teachers may be getting more sleep too. And maybe they're handling discipline in the classroom more effectively. I mean, who knows? What do you think, David?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Adam, did they speculate at all? Did they cite any particular research that would point to a particular causal mechanism there?
Yeah, they don't talk about the teachers getting more sleep. I think that's an interesting thing that maybe should be investigated more. It'd be hard to tease out, but there is a body of psychological research that just says that more sleep makes people better off, particularly young people, but really all of us need more sleep. I know I'm more prone to misbehavior when I haven't had my sleep. So it's pretty intuitive that people are, going to do better if they're getting more sleep. I guess I wonder about how long this effect can last. There's been a little bit of research that shows that students don't start staying up later just because the school start time changed. But it seems like in the long run, wouldn't they have to? I mean, isn't the whole reason that you go to sleep at a certain time because you have to get up at a certain time? I'm not sure about all that.
Yeah, you would think so. The other big issue, of course, is what this means for extracurricular activities. This has been one of the pain points in places is, you can only push the school day back so much if you're trying to get in football practice and band rehearsal and all the rest, especially before the sun goes down. And so, how do you deal with that? And does this mean that some of the schools are pushing schools start times maybe have benefits in some of these ways, but they might be losing out in other ways?
Yeah, well, I'm not an expert either, but I mean, I know there's logistical challenges too, like with buses and parents' work schedules. I mean, it sounds simple, but it's unfortunately it's not.
Well, our colleague Madison Yoder in the Ohio office actually wrote a review last year of a Rand Corporation study that was based on some previous work on this school start time thing, but it was doing a cost benefit analysis. And they even factored in things like installing lights on the football field so that you could have football practice a little later. Mm-hmm. They factored in a bunch of the stuff that you're talking about and still found really big positive effects in the cost benefit analysis if the effects on academic outcomes are as strong as a lot of these studies have suggested.
Hey, man, and that's just for pushing the day back a little bit. I mean, let's say we didn't start school until noon. We could wipe out the achievement gap.
I'm into it.
All right. Okay, Adam. Thanks so much. I'm afraid that is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net. We'll be right back.